Nojov or Maria this week. Instead, some of the public testimony from January 11th's Seattle Community Police Commission Community Engagement Meeting. This is a 57-minute segment extracted from the two-hour meeting. The next public engagement meeting will take place Tuesday, February 8th at 6 p.m.
Dr. Howard Gill, I see that your hand was probably up first.
It was. Thank you. I'm just befuddled here. I don't even know where to start. If we go back to 2010, where the killing of John T. Williams by the SPD is what kicked off the consent decree and the monitor. If we went back to that and we were having a discussion like this, where a bunch of random numbers generated by SPD were thrown at us, we would say, hey, looks good. And we would forget about it. But here's the kicker. Last week, the 19th person in mental health crisis was killed by the SPD. We're looking at graphs and numbers that have absolutely inflated denominators and are really uninterpretable when there's two things we know dead to rights, one from the SPD's own contracted evaluation, which there still is racial bias and use of force. And then the other thing we know is last week we had the classic instance, just like Terry Caver in 2020, we had a person of color in extreme mental health crisis with edged weapons get flat out murdered. That's, I think, what we need to be talking about tonight. So I want to again point something out.
Okay,
let me finish.
Okay, wait just a second. We already had the rules of engagement, okay? And I'm gonna let you finish your thought right now, but you need to know we have almost 100 people on this call. So we're not gonna be able to go into complete detail, but if you want answers and follow up, you're more than welcome to email either myself or Dr. Oftelli. You can contact us any other way. But tonight, we're staying on topic, and we're not going to, we just don't have the time, and we just,
okay. I'm sorry. If, Felicia, if that's the topic, when we just murdered a human being, if that's the topic,
okay. I'm going to ask
statistics,
you,
then goodbye. Goodbye.
Okay. Well, Felicia, maybe I can address that to some degree. So Dr. Gill, I hear you, right? I completely, I'm distressed by what happened last week, right? I think part of what we're trying to do with this job here tonight and what I've been hired to do is to look at, you know, comprehensively and systemically, these measures from Seattle. We will always, you know, there have been incidents, horrific incidents for everyone involved, that Seattle needs to have accountability around, needs to learn from, perhaps needs discipline on, whatever it may be. But what we're trying to do, so one is that that is in process with last week, right? Forced investigation team was on point. OPA, OIG were there. That's going into review. There will be, flow into a process around accountability, and that needs to happen, and it will happen. If it doesn't happen,
Dr. Oftelli, what you're saying was done with the other 18 cases before that. FIT certified everything is lawful and proper. OPA certified everything is lawful and proper. That's what the discussion should be about tonight. It's not, let's look and see what happens about last week's case. It's about, what about the 18 other cases, a lot of which were very similar to John T. Williams. Why were those deemed lawful and proper? Lawful and proper.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. No. And I think what we can go with this, with the questions that we have for community, is what needs to happen next, right? So if the community as a whole says we need to better understand and be able to perhaps change laws around around force that's used and if that's appropriate force or not, and change those laws from a state perspective, city perspective. That's on the table, right? I mean, that's something that CPC could engage in, that the community can engage in to change the parameters of what's lawful in these types of incidents. So, and that's something that the community can take on. It is within the scope of what we're talking about tonight, but also we need to talk about the overall trend lines of data and where SPD is on those broader, you know, aggregate trends. But also, I think over time, really, again, look at individual incidents through a very critical lens, not only from a federal monitoring perspective, yeah, but also from community, right? So I think we can do both of those.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Gale. Erica?
Hi, Felicia. Thank you. Hi. This is Erica. I'm one of the commissioners on the CPC. And I was I had a question regarding one of the slides, the assessment findings. I wasn't able to jot down my note, but what I recall seeing was that the numbers appeared to be slightly lower in 2020 than what they were in 2016. With those numbers, I was wondering if there's any more detail as far as maybe the zip codes that the calls originated from, considering the police departments have different precincts that respond to different locations. But also, could the lower percentage rate have anything to do with COVID and the police force being a little less than what it's been in the past?
Right, Erica. So I think what you're referring to is the arrest rate. And so in 2016, the arrest rate of someone who was experiencing a crisis incident was 7.5%. In 2019, it was 8.62%. And in 2020 was 6.3%. So it went down a bit. So let me make sure I have these years correct here. I'm sorry. Okay. So, in 2016, 7.5%, 2019, 8.62%. And, in 2020 was 6.3%. And so it declined in 2020. I maybe will turn to SPD to see if there's any patterns in there that can explain that a bit, but it may have been because of, just, you know, all the patterns of what happened in 2020, with just the number of people out and you know, COVID and whatnot. Lieutenant Piskonski, any insight there on those arrest numbers?
Dr. Offaly, I could probably answer that. So we had seen a reduction in the amount of calls for service during 2020. So we saw a sharp drop in calls. At COVID, there were a lot of different changes, things that had been shut down, less people on the streets, you know, calling in. Sometimes that affects crisis calls. So we have not sure if that was a correlation to it, but we did see just in general an overall reduction in 911 calls for service. So,
did that answer your question, Erica?
It answered my question a little bit. I understand that there's more people on the line, so I will make some notes and then I can follow up offline.
Thank you so much. Uh-huh. There is a question about how does SPD define crisis? I don't know which one of you guys want to take that.
Lieutenant Piskonski, why don't you take that?
Absolutely. I will. In fact, I am going to give me just a quick second here, and boom, I just put it into the chat there. So that's actually right from our policy, and that's the definition that we utilize for crisis, and that was developed in conjunction with the Crisis Intervention Committee, with the monitoring team, and with the DOJ as we were coming, you know, that initial part of that settlement agreement, and all the parties were getting together and coming up with, okay, what is a workable definition going to be? So that's where that came from. We've used it ever since. And yeah.
Okay. Let's see, Jerome.
Hey, yes, good evening. So I'd like to respond to the monitor's questions. And I hope I can be forward and respectful at the same time for the rules of engagement. I guess the first thing I'd say is that there was some pushback to the other gentleman who brought up last week's incident in response to this conversation. And I want to say, you know, what we see as the public are these incidents. And, you know, we don't have time to go into every incident, and SP doesn't show the data for us to know what those statistics represent. So when we want to see how our police department is doing, we really look to these incidents. And I guess what I'd like to highlight about this incident is that the officer in question had been disciplined multiple times for improperly using a dog in the past. And instead of firing that officer, we let him continue to be part of the SPD, and now he's killed someone. And I guess what I would tell to the monitor is, you know, we'll see what this investigation says. But really, from my perspective, I just don't think it's acceptable that that officer was continued to be allowed on the force given their disciplinary record. And now, you know, look at here we are. So I know there's a lot that goes into that with the CBA, et cetera, et cetera. But what I would say is I really have not seen progress towards removing bad officers from the force under the 10 years of the consent decree. And if I'm going to be forward, I would say that's where we need focus. And we need a lot of focus. And you know, the standard the officers are held to right now really is so much lower than, you know, what the citizens here deserve. And I think you know, the OPA really has not been effective in holding officers to a high standard of behavior. And I really think that contributed to the incident we saw last week. So that's what I'll say. And I will turn it back to you.
Yeah, no, Jerome, that was Jerome, right? Thank you for that. It's, you know, as I said before, the hardest part for all of us, I think, with this work is trying to, you know, is trying to hold a couple, two different things in our heads, right? You know, one is this idea of how do we look at SPD from a systemic lens, right? Just year over year, the major trends, these abstract numbers, as we call them, knowing that behind the numbers are real people, right? There are families, there are friends, there are community members, there are neighbors, right? That are an incident, right? That someone in crisis. And so this holding one in our minds and our heads around how do we just look at this year over year and these trends to better understand systemically what needs to change. But then two, knowing that we have to look at each one of these individual incidents as well. And looking at those individual incidents from this lens of accountability, right? So this assessment work we've been doing around crisis intervention looks more systemically at just what, you know, what's happened over year. The accountability work that the monitoring team works on with federal oversight looks at, as well as the city and CPC looks at, is that other area, right? Where we have to say, you know, what do we do there around these individual incidents to make sure that the outcomes from these are lawful, they're constitutional, they're fair, they're equitable, they're reasonable, all these other, you know, criteria that we need to have going forward for the future in Seattle. And so I think with, you know, on this conversation tonight, we do need to hold both of these two types of areas in our minds and be thinking about that. Part of when we talk about what comes after tonight's call and you know, these three big questions that we had or what comes next in 2022, I think can be, Jerome, and to Dr. Gale's comments, can be around that, right? So we, as community, you can say, hey, CPC, hey, monitoring team, here are things that we need to look at in 2022. Here are things that we need to try and change, or at least ideas we should explore. If, for example, you know, it seems like that there isn't accountability in some of these incidents, or the policy in engaging someone was maybe an incorrect policy or could be changed over time, that's something we can look at and port into our 2022 work to say, what can we accomplish as CPC? What can we accomplish from the monitoring perspective? Should maybe go to the state level for legislation, right? So again, so I appreciate what you're saying, and I'm hoping we can channel that energy you have into some ideas around where we go next in 2022, both on systemic and on the individual incidents.
If you don't mind, I'd like to respond really quickly. I guess what I'd say is I get that the federal monitor is trying to look at this systemically. What I've seen personally from the federal monitor is that the federal monitor seems more concerned with documenting progress than really rooting out problems. And I think the other gentleman kind of said it well. With crisis response, you know, how you categorize that data could paint a very different picture. But what's, you know, a lot of us individuals are seeing is we've been doing this federal monitor thing for 10 years, and we still have no confidence in the police department. So I, you know, I won't ask you to respond again, but I hope you'll take that away. That, you know, a lot of us who live here don't have confidence in the department, and we really don't have confidence in the federal monitor because we haven't really seen any tangible progress. So thank you again.
Yeah, no, and I understand that frustration from the perspective of a community member, although I don't live in Seattle, but I'm, you know, a Minneapolis resident. So I understand where you're coming from, that sentiment. The monitoring team, DOJ and the monitoring team have, you know, we have a certain job that we're hired to do, right? And that job is looking at systemically this type of work, but as well as looking at accountability. And making sure the system is in place for accountability. So OPA and OIG and what happens with officer discipline, officer, you know, review of incidents and learning that takes place and discipline that takes place around that. So there is some teeth, you know, in that. So for example, I know we're spending maybe too much time on this, but it's important because a lot of people are bringing this up. Yeah. If the monitoring team and DOJ, you know, if we saw a pattern where incidents weren't being investigated, right? Where there was policy being broken, where there was no discipline when that policy was broken, right? That's something that would, from an accountability perspective, the monitoring team would weigh in on, right? And work with the city to try and fix. And so these areas, when we talk about these individual incidents, like last week, it's something that is on the radar, right? That we can work with community on to make sure that we find, you know, that those issues are resolved, right? And so it is something that we can work on with you.
iPhone, I think that might be you, Deontay.
It is.
Thank you for being here.
Most definitely happy to be here. I think the issue that I think is bothering me a little bit with the presentation that was shown is just, we're talking about helping the people in the spaces of crisis. And what was put in the message space was a damn paragraph, as if that was like a clear definition of assisting our community members in the spaces of crisis. And I'm thinking about how us being impacted by COVID, and I know that we've had a lot of people, there's been more definition, more bigger definitions, such as people in drug-induced states. And I'm just really having a hard time. It's more so of the issue that I'm having is just like, where is the rest of the damn data? It just doesn't seem like it's clear with the definition of how to, I don't. And trust me, I live to look into SPD data, ex-Felicia. I love having these conversations, but I just feel like this one is a little bit more performative, so to speak, especially when it comes to assisting our community members in crisis. That's really all the hell I really had to say. It just doesn't seem very clear on SPD's navigation on what that would look like to assist us in the areas of crisis. I can't understand how the numbers would be low in 2020 and high in 2016. It just doesn't rub me the right way. I just had to say it because I love Ask Queenie. She on the line. She know I live for this data and love looking into it, but it just, I'm still surprised at the little paragraph that it has in the areas of what defines crisis, which can pretty much define exactly why we keep on having these issues with cops and our community members to begin with. And that's it.
So, well, thank you for that. And I didn't get your name there, sir.
It's Deontay. It's like Beyonce, but I'm broke.
Okay. Wonderful. Deontay. So first, I guess what I'd say is, you know, thank you for that. And I would really encourage you to go on to this Seattle Police Monitor.org website and download the full assessment for crisis intervention, right? Because you'll see the full scope of everything we've looked at. So in this session tonight, purely, it's just like a real high level flyover that I presented to you tonight, just like real top level insights based on that, the large document, right? So if you can access that, you'll see the full spectrum of data there. And from that, ideally, if you could give us some ideas on those three questions we talked about, would love to have your insight and your community experience based on that. Just mention as well that all that assessment work that we did was focused in on SPD, right? So we have to also realize that for people experiencing a crisis situation, there are a lot of factors that go into that, a lot of multidisciplinary services that the city needs to build up, and housing and health and human services and addiction services, et cetera, right? So that's that broad stroke lens, that ecosystem is not something that's reflected, you know, in this assessment. We're purely looking at SPD. So, but going forward, right, I think one of the key ideas coming out of that is that we should have for the city broadly, you know, a real strong focus, if you can advocate for that, around how does the city better respond to help people who are in crisis across all these different domains, these different professions, these different disciplines of mental health and housing and human services, et cetera, right? So if you can advocate for that, that would be you know, valuable for the city. But please do look at the full data on the website, as well as on the dashboard that Seattle Police Department puts out.
Okay. Mother Walden.
Thank you for letting me speak. One of the things that I think that people that we are frustrated with is that for people who work to bring the DOJ to town, people who work to set up this system, I mean, I think there's two things that's going on. I think the broader community, and some of us also, hoped that the police shootings would go down. Okay, and all of this. And so for people, for a lot of us, seeing police accountability and police departments getting better is that the departments are out of policy, that some of the shootings would not always be in policy, that we can get some police officers charged or fired, as someone that was talking about multiple events. And so this consent decree does not get to the problem of how do you get rid of bad officers, okay? And the city was found out of compliance on the accountability system. That system still needed to be fixed. And so people, what we're talking, the frustration is that we all know who do this work. If the policy is not updated or if the policy has not been trained to, there would be no discipline. But if the policy always finds or that the officer is in, you know, in policy shooting, whether it's with knives or, you know, of that. And so when you look at what people looked at and was looking for police accountability on the 34 groups of people who signed the letter to have to bring the DOJ to town and to set this system up, there's two different realities. I mean, we were talking about data, and data is fine, but on the other side of the equation, the shootings did not go down. I mean, with people who and I, as a person who worked to bring who said, as mothers who brought the crisis intervention back from Oregon to Seattle, I know that most of the calls are handled successfully, and that's one thing that the community might not understand, that most of the calls are handled successfully. It's the ones that's not handled successfully. It's the one like the gentleman down on the waterfront. I mean, he was in distress. Now I think the Seattle Police Department is going to have the bowler wrap. Something else can help people in distress with knives that they don't, that officers are not killing people. So we have two different tracks here. We have the data, we have the assessments. We have the areas where the police department was found out of compliance and unconstitutional. That's what you're here to talk about. And then we have the fact that that a gentleman just got killed last week. And you know, Dr. O'Telly, even in Boston, where you from, I don't care how good the work is in the community, if it's a shooting, you back to square one. And I don't think people understand that. I mean, I don't think, so the assessment is fine, but it was a shooting last week. And so now we still back to square one and all of that. So all I'm saying is that it's two different tracks. It's two different trains here. And I think that I want you to understand that it's two different tracks. When we talk about police accountability, we're also talking about that we want the shootings to go down. We want officers charged with a crime. We want officers, multiple shooters that's on every police department in America, multiple shooters to be somehow moved off the force, because most of the shootings in Seattle and across the country are by officers who have already had multiple shootings. And it's no place that the consent decree gonna fix that. So some of the things that need to be fixed, it's not gonna get fixed on the sustainment plan. How's that get? So I think it's two parallel tracks here that people are talking about and the frustration. So if you can think about this as you bifurcate, think about the 10 assessments, the 10 areas that the city was found out of compliance, and CIT was one of those. Use of force, stops and detention, and all of that, all of those areas. And that's what the assessment is on. But how does that assessment fix this piece that people are talking about today? How do those 10 assessments will ever fix these pieces if the policy is not updated and the officer is not trained to the policy? It will be no discipline. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that, Reverend Walden. And I broadly agree. It was a bit back to Deontay's question as well, right? I think that there's, and before that, we had another person that brought that up, and that there's the comprehensive assessment, again, is looking at data over long term, over trends, right? It's one lens that we're discussing tonight around better understanding where SPD is and performing lawfully and constitutionally for people in crisis, right? So we'll have another session on stops and detentions, another one on use of force in the coming each month here in this forum to talk about all those. Each one of those areas will not only have the data, but also we'll have this other side that we were talking about around accountability, right? And there's accountability into the question a bit from, it's up here way. Someone asked how we define accountability, and in broad ways, we're looking at that both from the front, what we call front-end accountability, and back-end accountability. Front-end being accountability measures, things like policies and practices and training that are put in place before an officer hits the streets to prevent bad things from happening and to hopefully increase the number of positive outcomes that happen when an officer is out on patrol and dealing with incidents. So all that front end work is a piece of accountability, because we're trying to be proactive and prevention oriented. Then there's back end accountability. So in the areas where there is some unfortunate incident where there's an officer breaks policy, does something that's not lawful or constitutional in many different categories, that there's a process in place on the back end to make sure that there's that incident is investigated, that there's discipline if warranted, or at the very least that the system as a whole learns from that. So we have to be dealing with both of these. And everyone on these calls, when we talk about the individual incidents, we can look at that accountability from both sides, right? From last week's incident, are there things that needed to be done better around the preventive side? Around this, around front end accountability. That's an open question right now. Are there things in the back end around accountability after that incident that need to take place? And so we can look at both of those areas. CPC can look at that, the monitor can look at that. And so I guess, Reverend Walden, just the you're right, and that we have to do both of these, right? We have to be looking systemically at the data as well as at these at the accountability side around all this. And that's what we're trying to do. And we're going to, hopefully with the ideas that come from you guys as well, be able to do more of that in 2022.
Okay. Austin.
Thank you, Felicia. Thank you for organizing this too. And thank you, Dr. Uptelli, for your time. I appreciate it. I can everybody hear me? I'm on a headset. Okay.
Yes, we can hear you.
I admit I'm confused that we've talked so much about accountability this evening, because I was under the impression that the monitoring team's position was that officer discipline was not part of the consent decree. And if I've got that backwards, that's on me. But my impression has been that that the monitoring team and Judge Robart have been at odds about that a little bit, because obviously the judge found Seattle out of compliance on accountability because of the way that the accountability ordinance was weakened by the SPOG contract. But my impression just from CPC meetings and from speaking to you previously was that that was that and other forms of officer discipline were viewed as outside of the scope of the consent decree. So I would just appreciate a little bit of clarification on that, because I really appreciate what Reverend Walden said about the fact that, you know, if policies are not enforced, then there's not going to be any discipline, and everything that we're doing here is up in the air.
Yeah, thank you for that, Austin. It is a difficult area to parse, right? And there's a lot of real detailed differentiation, I suppose you could say, in when we look at accountability and what federal oversight looks like there from the consent decree perspective. What I would say is that broadly, there's from the consent decree, there were certain structures and systems that were put in place, and that the city built years over year, right? So this accountability system, this triad, including the CPC, OPA, and OIG, right, as the accountability partners. And so from, and I will maybe turn here as well to Matt Walder from DOJ to augment or correct what I'm saying or give his perspective. But from the monitoring perspective, what we look at is systemically, is that accountability structure and system in place? Do you have a functioning OPA? Do you have a functioning OIG? Do you have a functioning CPC? And is there, when we have this, if there's the front end accountability and tracking that from a policy perspective, but in the back end, if something bad does happen, does that accountability triad, is that operational and functional and working, right? What the monitoring team does not have any jurisdiction, quote unquote, over, or is the rules that are in place, the laws around if something is lawful or not, that are put in place by everything from the the federal level to state law to city law. We don't look at that, and we can't say we can't augment those rules, for example, right? And so we look at this more systemically. But we can partner, though, with CPC, with the community, to elevate issues, right? So if we find a pattern of something that goes wrong in a particular area, say crisis intervention, and we see that the policies are failing in a preemptory way around these and in the front end way, we can work with you to change those policies and to work with the city to change those policies, right? And so there's a lot of differentiation there in what we can and cannot do on that. If it's valuable to the members here on the call, I wonder if Matt Waldrop, if you wouldn't mind augmenting that perspective.
Sure. And I think you've generally got the concept correct, right? And I think sort of thinking about it as a triad is important. And then within that, sort of the work that the monitor can do with that, with the city and with the department, and sort of augmenting those policies, changing those policies, and adjusting them as needed. I think that sort of hits the nail on the head with how that all works.
Thank you for that. If I could briefly follow up, I promise I won't take too much time, but it seems to me that in the chat, we've identified some patterns when it comes around accountability, particularly the fact that every shooting since the consent decree was instituted has been found lawful by this accountability triad and potentially by its predecessor. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. But it seems as though patterns have been identified. So I'm just sort of curious where the tipping point is that we start saying that this accountability system isn't functioning very well. You know, I mean, when you've got a clear pattern like that, and then you have other troubling indicators like whistleblowers at OIG, you have OIG refusing to certify OPA investigations from time to time. You have a lot of people raising a lot of very serious concerns about the functioning of this accountability system. And then you have obviously issues like the ruse, the lie, which I know is outside of the thing, stuff we're talking about tonight, but you know, something that definitely shakes the faith of the community and the accountability system. I mean, where is the tipping point where patterns have been identified and issues have been raised, and at a certain point, you know, the monitor takes that up?
No, Austin, it's a solid question. You know, I think that let me just say too, I know there's a lot of questions coming in via the chat here and comments. We are capturing all that so we can, you know, so we can figure out a way to synthesize this. In addition, there's been a number of people who sent me a direct message. I'm not able to type directly back to you guys. So I think we can capture those too. And or you can email me, or I'll try and get back to people with these direct messages. But so Austin, I think I don't have a concrete direct answer to this right now, but I think what we can do though is take all the everything you guys have been saying here and take a look at it from, you know, what we're asking for all the community here is, what do we do in 2022, right? We have kind of these broad strokes, the data, you know, from the trend lines of, you know, we're talking about crisis interventions, and I know we broaden the scope here a little bit in some of our conversations, but, you know, what do we do around this in 2022? If we're saying that generally the patterns and the practice from you know, the trend lines are look okay, that's one thing. If we're saying though that, hey, there's just some problems when it comes to the individual incidents, and we have to really look concretely at whether or not OPA and OIG have, you know, the number, the amount of people they need, the, you know, the bandwidth, the expertise, the whatever it may be that we need to look at, their policies or practices, that's something we should put on the table, right? If the community says we need to look more at that issue with the city, you know, I can figure out tomorrow, you know, what role the federal monitor can have with that. But for sure, we can bring this up as an issue that needs to be resolved. I know that going, if we're from a community perspective, if we're saying, what do we do with this consent decree? It's been 10 years. What more can we accomplish with it? There's dialogue there that we need to have we should have on this, right? If the community feels like the federal oversight does not help with these areas around accountability that a lot of people are mentioning, then, you know, we need to have the city do more on that, right? If you think there are areas that the monitoring team and DOJ can really look at in 2022 to help with this, let's get it on paper, right? Let's figure out a plan to do that in 2022. And we can work with, you know, DOJ and the court to, you know, to figure out how much we can do from the federal side on this. And so, you know, I guess in a broad way, I'm just saying that, you know, we want your ideas on this. And if we legitimately come to closure with the consent decree at some point in the future, whether it's end of this year or in, you know, 2030, we need to make sure that we've done everything we can to resolve these areas that you're talking about.
Okay. I see Amy Tan.
Hi. Thank you for arranging this meeting. I wanted to talk about crisis intervention, but since we have strayed a bit from that, I do just want to say regarding accountability that that is a huge concern of mine. And from what I've observed, our system is not functioning as a community member would hope. And I appreciate what you just said, but I also think as community members, we don't always know what we're asking the city to do more. Like, we're asking for people to help, and sometimes it doesn't feel like anyone is listening, or we don't know the best route forward. Because it seems like every time we try a new route, there's a roadblock that's put up. So that is around accountability, that is definitely a concern of mine. But I did want to talk about crisis intervention and answer the questions that you so kindly provided for us ahead of time a little bit, to say that I would really like to see some alternate crisis intervention systems in the city. I know we already have some smaller programs like, you know, through the fire department, for example, but I would like to see those programs expanded. I would like to see something that's more community-based, whether that's some kind of CAHOOTS-like model or STAR from Denver, or whether it's a different kind of community-based model. And I feel like we have a lot of data because there are a lot of programs like this that already exist in the United States and that have existed for some time. So it's not like they're brand new and we don't know what's happening. I do feel like there's some obstructionist thinking or maybe just a lack of urgency in trying to really put together a plan to make this happen. And I hope that now that we have a new mayor, maybe that would help. But also to answer the second question, I would love to see the CPC take up this matter, perhaps to act as an advocate for community-based crisis intervention programs. I was talking to the new director of Olio back in December, and he is going to be acting as an advocate at the county level for these sorts of programs, and really sees one of Olio's reasons of being to be to research these sorts of programs, figure out a plan, and then really push for it. And I don't see that happening in Seattle. So I would love it if somebody were to take that on, whether that would be CPC or some other body.
Great. Great one. Thank you for that, Amy. I think the broadly definitely agree with you, right? I think the city has done quite a bit of work. I don't have the exact stats in front of me right now, but there's been a pretty big investment, but needs to grow in areas of alternative response. So Health One, which is the fire department, which you talked about, has a team stood up on that. SPD has had multidisciplinary teams with mental health professionals that have accompanied SPD. Might be able to turn to SPD.SC if that what the status of that is, if that's going to grow or not. But under the Durk administration, there was a concerted effort to look at, along with city council, to look at alternative forms of response and to start building that up, building that out year over year. Quite a bit of grant money has gone out already to the community to design new forms of community-based response, particularly to help people in crisis. So that work is ongoing. I don't know what the posture is of the new mayoral administration, but my assumption is that they're going to keep building on that along with city council. So the resource allocation decision, I think, to that is something that that the community needs to push on to continue to talk with city council and the mayor's office around continuing to resource those new forms of response and finding the balance of how quickly those can be built out and scaled up in order to respond in a robust way. And maybe over time to reduce the footprint of sworn officers that have to respond to these types of incidents, as well as building out the new 911, 988 infrastructure. The 988 was federally driven infrastructure that cities will have to respond to for people in crisis and to be able to send resources out in real time. So all that infrastructure needs to be built and scaled up. But you're right in that it's critical for the future. Most progressive cities are moving that way, and I would expect Seattle to as well.
I'll just follow up by saying I cover this, so I'm aware of what the city has been doing. I think that overall there has been a lack of urgency, and there have been roadblocks put up that I was disappointed to see being kind of deliberately placed. At least that's what it seemed from the outside. And I don't think enough is being done. And I think it's really easy to find excuses for why we can't do this. And so from my perspective, it's just been very frustrating because we see these solutions being implemented other places, being implemented more quickly and with less roadblocks. And these are the sorts of programs that honestly, there aren't a lot, there's not a lot of controversy around it. Like in general, people are in favor of this.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I think this, you know, I can't speak for every elected official in Seattle, of course, but, you know, I think if we look at last year and the, I think pretty much every city council member has been supportive of that type of work. SPD has been supportive of alternative response and helping to build that out. The mayor's office was. And so I think you're right. The so, yeah, I guess I would just say I agree. There isn't much there that federal oversight can do to propel that, right? So, because our job is to look directly at SPD and the trends there, but we, you know, can collaborate with the city on that, at least under the previous administration, was called the reimagining work to try and, you know, create channels for that work to happen. So whatever we can do there, we can, and please do submit those ideas again, even though they are being worked on. I think the more people we have talking about it, the better.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to take Ron, and then Emily, if you could put the poll questions up after Ron, we can start to get a little bit more into that. Thank you, everybody. Good questions, good comments, good conversation. Just to put a little background too, last month we had Lieutenant Piskowski from the crisis intervention team do a full presentation on crisis intervention. So I guess I kind of feel like it may feel like we're coming in the middle of a conversation instead of the background and all of all of the things that go into to SPD and their crisis intervention team. So I apologize for that because we did have a full presentation last time. So if it feels like the middle of a conversation, we definitely will do our best to get to everybody's questions and all the information in the chat. And I just can't thank you guys enough for being on the call. So with that being said, Ron, if you would like to go ahead.
Well, preliminarily, I want to address Austin Field. Austin, you've been asking certain questions with regard to use of force and crisis intervention methodology and statistics. I have consulted with the monitor and with Danny Murphy on our team, and I have a comprehensive answer, which may be of interest to you, answer a lot of your questions. Devontae being a self-described data maven, I think it might be of interest to you also. My email is ron@ronwardlaw.com. Please email me and I'll get that data to you. I'm giving you my email because Austin, I do not have yours, and Devontae, I do not have yours. But let me just say this. I've been involved with the consent decree since the end of 2012. Statistics wax and wane, but there is no doubt that the manner in which SPD deals with crisis intervention has improved vastly, vastly from when I started with this consent decree. That's a matter of record over a long period of years. That does not deal with the specific issue of specific fatalities, killings, tragedies. The consent decree was originally articulated with regard to the petitions of this community for the purpose of addressing patterns, practice, policy, systemic change. Ultimately, that is to put in place policies that preclude tragedies from happening via training and via repetition. It does not deal specifically, book, chapter, and verse, within the four corners of the doctrine, with officer misconduct other than through city agencies which deal with accountability. It does not deal with certain aspects of accountability because those are the subject of state law and of collective bargaining. One of the purposes of this series of community engagement sessions is to get your ideas so that we can use what influence we may have with city officials and with this system as a whole, with SBD, with Chief Diaz, in order to try to get actualized the things that perhaps the consent decree cannot reach. So there are individuals on this call who are absolutely encyclopedic with regard to the subject of police reform, with regard to the data, with regard to the statistics, with regard to innovations that are occurring around the country and other communities. Please, I implore you, don't just come to these sessions if you love your community and complain about the reality that is. Give us, you the community, the ideas, the tools to move forward in order to try to use what influence we have to affect what you want as reality in this community. More than that, I don't have anything to say. Austin, I really appreciate you getting me your email, and Devante, you also. Thank you.
Any follow-up?
Got four pages. Dr. Gill?
Dr. Gill, okay.
Yeah, I'll try to make this quick. So just in response to what Ron said, I think after 19 really stunningly horrible murders, if we have to communicate that to the monitor, I think we have a far, far deeper problem. But to get back to what was said before, the CAHOOTS model is not going to stop things like the people in mental health crisis that are getting killed. CAHOOTS would not have stopped Charlena Lyles from getting killed. It wouldn't have stopped any of the 19 people, frankly, because they did have some form of weapon, and it just wouldn't have been a proper model. The point is, Camden, New Jersey, a lot of other police departments over the last 6 years, 7 years, have sent officers to train in England to be able to deal with people that have blunt weapons, edge weapons, things that are not guns, and how to contain them and how to take them down and preserve their life. This is not rocket science. This has been going on for years. It's been going on for at least 6 or 7 years in the US where we send people. It's been going on for 40, 50 years in the United Kingdom where no one with a knife gets killed, except for the rare cases of terrorism. Last thing I'll say is this. The way these injustices get perpetuated is by fractioning things off. Let's have a conversation about use of force. Let's have a conversation about crisis intervention. But these things are all tied together. And as I said in my comment, I'll say it again. If an officer can beat the living shit out of people like they did in 2020 and get off scot-free, which pretty much 99% of them did, and these are white people of means on TV, and yet they got off scot-free, why wouldn't you feel a certain degree of entitlement and freedom to abuse people of color, which I see happening all the time? So these things are not separate. What happened in 2020, if we don't have accountability for that, which we don't, and we're finding out more and more of what's gone wrong, then how are we going to stop these other things? We can't fraction them off and say, oh, demonstrations are here, crisis intervention is here, the fact that the police flagrantly lied and put people in a dangerous situation in CHOP in 2020, that's over here. No, these things are all part of a piece. Last thing, I know I said the other thing was last thing, but here's the real last thing. No amount of training, no amount of policy is going to make a difference without accountability. Tell me what area, I work in psychology, I've worked in hospitals my whole life. Give me one example where there isn't accountability, where if you don't follow the training and policy, there isn't an immediate consequence. We have set up historically for 160, 170 years in the United States, a system where there is no accountability. So we've gotten it backwards. We shouldn't be working on policy. We should not be working on training. First thing we have to do is have accountability. Then we can start to put policies in effect, and when they violate them, hold them to account. Thank you.
No, thank you for that, Dr. Gill. You know, I guess what I would be fantastic to see right, is I think we've posed a series of questions to, you know, to this forum here in community. Dr. Gill, you've been quite eloquent in this meeting and previous others at, you know, talking about the number of people who've been killed by SPD around accountability that hasn't happened. Give us concrete ideas on where we should go next with those. So in regards to, say, for example, 19 or whatever the number of people that's killed over, you know, the previous however many years, it would be great if you could, instead of continually bringing it up, document each one of those and say, here's exactly where a policy was broken or where a policy should be changed so that we can hold an officer accountable. We can then see, is that something that federal oversight can help with, or is it something that the state legislature needs to take on to say changing some type of law in order to be able to change the policy, right? If the accountability structures and systems review an incident and they find that it was lawful, it's because they're reviewing it from the laws that are on the books. If we need to change the laws, then we should try and do that, right? But it's going to require more than just continuing to say everything is broken. And we need to say, okay, what exactly do you want to fix? And so what I do is I welcome and maybe even challenge you, because you've been on these calls continuously and you've never given actually any concrete idea on how to change those laws. Work with us on it. Work with us on it. Put it on paper.
I'm sorry. I do have to interrupt and push back. I've been very clear. The way to have accountability is the way they've done it in Nashville, the way they've done it in Oakland, the way they've done it in Portland, the way they've done it in San Diego, the way they've done it in Newark, New Jersey. There is a way, and that is having full community control, so we're not having a disparate system where we have to talk to you, we have to talk to the CPC, the OPA, the OIG, everything gets lost. It's a very simple system. There should be full community control.
So you're saying that's an independent commission to review officer incidents that's civilian controlled, right? Civilian led.
Which is exactly what they have in Nashville.
Yeah, so let's put that on paper and continue to advocate that. That's not something federal oversight can put in place, yeah. Right? That's not the job.
It's right. And Dr. Oftelli, as you know, if you go to seattlestop.org, I've already put that out 100 times, seattlestop.org, we have a fully articulated law based on the best of what Newark and Nashville and Portland and Oakland and San Diego and 20 other cities have done. We have that. As you full well know, the only impediment, we could have brought that to the federal court or to you, we could have brought that to the monitor and to the federal court and had that as the high bar. Instead, we set a low bar where we have this bizarre system where police, let me remind everyone, if they're not tracking, to this very day, police investigate police. A lot of hands up, let people speak.
Thank you, Dr. Gill.
Respond to that. Dr. Gill, I don't disagree with you on the idea of putting that type of structure in place, right? I think what I'm trying to relay here with this is that this confines of what the monitoring team is, the job of the monitoring team is via the court, right? Is to track this stuff systemically within the current rules and structures that are there. There has to be a way to take these ideas, and there are ways. This is something that likely would take state legislative action to create that type of independent oversight body that's completely civilian led, right? That's something that you can take all this energy and direct to the state legislature, right? And you know, to the degree we can help with that, if I have to put other hats on, right, I can try and help with that. And then I'm sure there are other people within the city that would as well. I guess the best way to try and do that is to channel that. I know, yes, the website is there. The actual policy is there. We can't do anything necessarily about that under the jurisdiction of the monitor, but we can, you know, the community can try and advocate for that at the state level to make those kind of changes.
If there is nothing else, then good night. And I'll see you next month, February the 8th. Thank you. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Felicia. Be well.
You were just listening to public testimony given at the January 11th Seattle Community Police Commission Community Engagement Meeting. It was the first of a series of three public forums. The next forum will be Tuesday, February 8th at 6 p.m.